Before we start this week's episode, we'd like to remind you folks that the Air Raid podcast is available at many places, including the Stitcher Radio app for your mobile device, iTunes, our website air-raid.net, and of course at www.cairoradio.com. Well, hello and welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Air Raid Podcast. This is episode 221 in what is now officially considered a long and drawn-out series. I am your host, Aaron Roden, and this, of course, is the show where we drop bombs of awesome straight into your ear holes. Boom indeed, folks. We've got a great show planned for you this week. Let's see, Ryan Devlin of the band Smokey Brights, a local Seattle outfit, will be joining us here in the backyard to talk about his their first full-length EP. Or wait, EP, LP, LP. Got him mixed up, man. Can't do that. Seemed like a hack. First full-length LP coming out November 11th. That's Tuesday, if you're hearing this on November 10th, 2014. It's called Taste for Blood, and it is very, very good. And I'm excited to share some of the tracks with you guys. It's a fantastic album. And he'll be joining me here in the backyard shortly to talk about the making of it. Kind of why it took them 3 years to make a full length. And let's see. Amongst other things, we get into a little discussion about religion as well, right? Yeah, and I share some thoughts. Some stuff that I've been thinking about lately that I can't push out of my mind, and I don't know if it's I'm like becoming more religious. I have no idea. I was a little drunk. I'm not gonna lie to you folks, right? Because that's my new thing. I'm not keeping anything from you. Something happened to me last week's episode. Episode 220 with the fabulous psychotherapist Joe Guppy, who just wrote this awesome book called My Fluorescent God. If you haven't listened to this episode yet, please, I urge you to do so. It was a great conversation about Joe Guppy's psychotic break that he had back in like 1979. And it's very, very interesting. And he goes through this story in detail, even reads a couple passages from the book. But something, this book, reading that book opened something up in me. And I felt obligated to kind of talk about my history with depression and schizophrenia. And a bunch of you guys reached out. And it sounds like that was appreciated. That was much appreciated. Now, I come from my background, like, I don't like talking about this stuff. I don't know how to talk about it, and for some reason, I have this, you know, anxiety about talking about it, because I feel like my problems, the stuff that I have experienced in my life, is much more subdued than other people's problems, and people just look at me and say, "Yeah, fucking buck up, man." Those are not big issues, right? But it's my experience. It's my experience, and I need to be comfortable with that. And I need to be comfortable. I need to be more comfortable with talking to you guys about that as well, right? Even though it's a one-sided conversation most of the time, I need to be more comfortable with telling you guys that kind of stuff, and putting it out there. That's the gist I'm getting from the emails that I've got. And I'm going to read one right here that touched me. I'm going to keep this anonymous. But this came in after episode 220. Dude, I really appreciated your opening up and talking about your situation. Speaking about my depression and schizophrenia. Or battles with those things. I've seriously been considering telling everyone about my bipolar disorder. Let's see. What holds me back is that I think people turn their backs on it. They say a bunch of mean, thoughtless things. They assume you're a bad person behind closed doors. So take the plunge and tell your listeners. So taking the plunge and telling your listeners is courageous. It makes me want to follow your lead. Stigmas don't erase themselves. We have to do it. Thank you so much for that email, Anonymous. I really appreciate it. I don't know if it makes me courageous to be able to talk about it. I don't feel that way. But I appreciate that you appreciate it. How's that? Did that come out okay? All right. But yeah, I feel like that book, My Fluorescent God, triggered something, and talking with Joe Guppy here on this show last week triggered something in me. And I feel a lot more comfortable talking about this stuff now. Like, I just went on another show based out of LA called Man School with Caleb Bacon. He's one of the writers for a television series called, I can't remember what it's called. Sanford and Sons. Sanford and Sons? Is that what it is? I apologize for getting that wrong if I did. And it was a great chat. The gist of the story that I was on there to tell was about my brother's condition and the resulting blood bone marrow transplant that we both went through to try to get him better. And it was a heavy, heavy experience, man. And the conversation kind of veered towards my childhood and how I dealt with his condition and things like that. And I really opened up and told some things that I haven't told anybody else except for my, wife and family. So it was fun. It was fun, and it was good to kind of get that stuff out there. And I'll let you guys know when that show goes up as well. So follow us on Facebook, because that's probably where it will be coming through. And you can also email me, like all these others have, at Aaron, A-A-R-O-N, at air-raid.net. We always appreciate getting email saying that you're listening and that you appreciate the show. That's great. And like I said last week, I'm trying my best to get back to these emails in a timely fashion. I don't know. There has been a little issue. A couple emails that I have sent back have bounced back to me. I think my email might be coming through as spam on some other people's email addresses. So if you don't get something back to me from me, just let me just know that I have tried. Okay. All right. Having trouble spitting stuff out. Okay, let's do this, shall we? Remember, folks, we are doing this little pledge drive right now and for the foreseeable future. The pledge drive, the Air Raid pledge drive. We're not asking for money. What we are asking for is for you guys to pledge to turn somebody else on to the Air Raid podcast, right? Or, just bring it up in conversation. If you liked something that we talked about, tell a friend, tell a lover, tell a family member. We'll take those two and maybe turn them on to the Air Raid podcast. We appreciate new listeners, and we need to get the word out about this little thing that we do here in the backyard because we want to grow. We want to grow, right? Yeah. Are we hoping to anyway? We want to reach other people. We want to tell people about this awesome music that is constantly coming out and that you need to hear about, and awesome comedy and awesome books and awesome movies, right? You guys like hearing about that stuff. That's why we do this show. I want to bring this stuff to the masses, right? And I think we do a pretty good job at it, right? Yeah, so take the pledge. Take the pledge. Tell somebody about the Air Raid podcast, or even steal their phone, take it to the bathroom at a party, and subscribe them to the show on iTunes, right? And then rate and review it for them as well. Why not? Why not just go the extra mile, right? Okay. But please do that. Take the pledge. Turn somebody else on to the show. Okay, let's do this. Let's go with our first musical break. Let's see. From the album, Taste for Blood, the debut LP, due out November 11th, 2014. That's Tuesday. And let's see. This first track is the title track, Taste for Blood. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid podcast for your ears with special guest Ryan Devlin of the band Smokey Brights. All right. Stay with us. I can't remember before I lost my taste for blood. Feel the footsteps fall. What a sound, what a sound.
I'm pretty Irish.
You're pretty Irish?
Well,
I guess Devlin, that sounds Irish.
Devlin is Irish. I think it's an Americanized version of Dublin, as far as
And my first name, makes sense.
Ryan Patrick Devlin.
O'Toole.
Yeah, no, and then they threw a James in there. Ryan James Patrick Devlin.
My first name is James.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I've got Irish in me.
There you go.
Yeah.
But you go by Aaron.
I go by Aaron, yeah. It's very confusing, and it's created a lot of problems when filling out, notarized paperwork. Because it's a family tradition in the Roden family to name your firstborn son James then go by their middle name. So my grandfather was James Earl.
Yep, yep.
His dad was James something. I can't remember his name. My cousin is James Eric. My uncle is James Dan.
So by design, you give your male child a middle name that would be a first name.
And it was a real source of contention for a little while between me and my wife, because we didn't know if we were going to have a boy or a girl.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, we got to name him James something if it's a boy.
It's been going that long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got to keep it up. You know, there's something to this whole thing. Right. And she was like, no,
yeah,
no, not at all. Cause she sees the problems that I have with it all the time. Like, I don't answer to the name James, but when somebody like, you know, our mortgage company or something, bank calls us, it's always James. Is James there? And everybody's like, who's James?
I'm always a little shocked when I meet a friend or I've known someone for years and then they're like, actually, my first name is this. And I just don't like it.
Right.
I feel like I've been lied to forever. You
right,
know?
Right. It really fucks with you, right? Little,
yeah.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah.
Sturdy. All right. James.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
Couple James. Couple Jameses here.
Yeah. Ryan Devlin joining me in the backyard. Thank you, sir, for coming over tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is good, right? You get to come to somebody's little studio and chat for an hour or so while drinking.
Yeah, that would be what I'm doing, just without a microphone. I would be chatting with maybe my wife.
Or by yourself.
By myself.
That's what I pictured, just you sitting in a corner.
And I would be drinking, looking sad in the mirror. Yep.
Well, you are the, would you say, lead vocalist?
Yeah, yeah.
And that, guitar player.
That sounds safe.
Yeah, yeah, for Smokey Brights here in Seattle.
That's true.
And you've got this new album coming out called Taste for Blood.
Yes.
Listening to this album, I was very impressed.
Thanks.
I like it a lot.
Good. Good.
I also really enjoyed your performance at Timber this year.
That was a fun one.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of pink balls.
Pink beach balls.
Yeah, beach balls.
Yes. There were pink balls.
Yeah.
I'm sure. But
I really yeah. This whiskey, it's great.
It's good stuff.
It's good stuff.
It's good stuff. It's going to catch on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was meaning to because I had to talk your wife into giving me an extra one because I couldn't grab one.
Oh.
People were grabbing them when you guys...
I know. They were all gone. It was great.
At Timber, you guys pushed out 100 of these pink beach balls into the crowd.
Yeah.
And they were all gone.
A lot of kids grabbed them. Yeah.
Yeah. I need to get one for my daughter because she loves pink things.
Yeah.
And so I asked Kim, I was like, hey, can I get another ball? And she's like, we really have to save these for
We were trying to save them for Bumper Shoot.
For Bumper Shoot.
Which we shouldn't have because no one told us we weren't playing outside.
Oh, really?
So we got to Bumper Shoot and it's a couple of the days were rainy, but we were actually on a sunny day. And we showed up wearing tank tops and Hawaiian shirts and we had 100 beach balls again. And then we were playing in the indoor stage that turned into a rave at night. And so when we threw the beach balls out in there, it was obscene. It just didn't make any sense. Beach balls
belong
outside.
Everybody was what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we should have given them all to your
daughter. Good job. Yeah. Well, Kim did give me one.
Oh, good.
I told her, I was like, I'm going to take a picture of this and I'm going to post it and I'm going to plug you guys. Awesome. And then I never did.
There were sufficient pictures of the beach balls.
Yeah, I figured, a lot of other people did it. So I was in the clear.
No, I think it kind of woke up a lot of people that were just maybe day drinking, laying on their blanket in the
sun.
It
was very hot.
It was a hot day.
I felt like when I was up there, no, first of all, nobody knew who the fuck I was when I was introducing bands.
I knew you.
You knew me. Yeah.
And the organizers knew because they contracted you.
But nobody there knew who I was except for a very small handful of people. And so when I got up there and was like, okay, everybody, let's pump up the energy.
Right.
And then I just, I slid back into my old ways of just starting to poke fun at the audience.
It's easy to do.
It's very easy.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially with a bunch of people who are just laying there comatose, waiting for the next band to come up on stage.
That's what bugs me about kind of festivals sometimes is it's a lot of music to sustain throughout the day.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But as a performer, you're you're giving your all. And if people are just kind of sitting on their blanket and eating the, picnic basket they brought.
Uh-huh.
It's a little different, especially when you're a rock band. So
yeah,
let's do something weird to force people off their feet. So,
you got the kids up at least.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They'll remember it. They'll eventually get credit cards. They'll buy our merch.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. So how long has Smokey Brights been a thing, man? How long have you guys been going?
I'm going to say going on 4 years, 3.5, something like that.
Really? That's it?
Yeah.
I thought you'd been around for longer than that.
It's weird. So I think that's the general, it feels like people think we've been around longer or more established. We got a review recently where it was these veteran Seattle rockers. And I was like, this is our debut full length. We're not veteran Seattle rockers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't hold us to that.
Are you a little bit embarrassed by that?
No, not at all. I think it's,
are you worried that people will think that?
No, I think it's cool and it's partially by design. I think we decided to hold off on putting out a full length and did kind of a weird EP to start and then a couple 7 inches and we played out a lot and we played a lot of festivals and stuff like that, but we've yet to put out a full length. So a lot of people have been like, no, this isn't your debut full length. And I'm like, no, it sincerely is. I'm not lying about that. So, but yeah, I mean, we've taken about three and a half years to figure it out. Figure out who we want to be when we grow up.
So. Yeah, well, that's good. Yeah. That's good. And it's been the same band the whole time, same members?
Pretty much. So Kim, my wife, was not an official member in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
But essentially, when I formed the band, I was playing in another band called The Hormones, who later became Hounds of the Wild Hunt, which is my other band.
Right.
So like super brash garage rock kind of stuff.
I didn't know you were in The Hormones. I didn't know that the Hounds of the Wild Hunt was like...
The Hounds of the Wild Hunt kind of spawned from The Hormones. So The Hormones, we started when we were like 19 or 20. It's
right.
Me and like two of my best friends in the world, Nikki and Johnny, were all from Tacoma. We moved up to Seattle when we were like, you know, 19, 20.
Yeah.
And then started The Hormones. And the whole idea was like, there was a lot of like really sleepy indie bands happening.
Yes.
And like, we were just really not into that at that moment. And we're right. Like, we're just going to have the most fuck you band imaginable. And we're going to play nothing but house parties. And we're just going to be big, sweaty, loud, ridiculous messes. Like the first single we called was called Jihad on Your Booty Terrorizing That Coochie, and it was just like everything was just like just bombast and just craziness, and we're screaming and like so we did that. And then like even by the time we like recorded our first record, we started to be like, oh, okay, like songwriting, we really like that. And then, you know, you at 25, your like prefrontal cortex fuses together the logic, the part of the brain like responsible for like forward thinking and logic. I think we like,
is this fact? Is this science fact?
It's science fact. Yeah. Okay. You can fact check it and add a little drop down menu on the website. I don't know. Anyway, I think the Hormones, the people involved in that were like, man, we're really doing something different. And people are just assuming that we're still just being bombastic, crazy weirdos, which is great, and we still are weirdos, like sincerely. But anyway, that project turned into Hounds of the Wild Hunt.
Gotcha. Because I think my old band,
mm-hmm. Did you play with us?
I want to say that we did, but it may have been one of the shows that I had tentatively lined up when we broke up.
Okay.
So I'm trying to remember, because I think I may have been in contact with you a long time ago on like MySpace or something.
It's
like that.
We were kings of MySpace for a minute.
Yeah,
it was great.
Yeah. Do you remember a band called The Huge?
The Huge?
Yeah. Or The Ministry of Love?
Those both sound like highly familiar.
Okay. I think we may have been in contact.
We might have
a
played a show
ago.
Or
that's so funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the music band guys, they just kind of...
I'm glad we didn't, though, because then you probably wouldn't be here right now.
Why is that?
We were just not very good. Oh. But, you know, we played a good live show.
Heck yeah.
I will say that.
Heck yeah.
I will say that. We just could not record. There was something about, like, did you ever have this problem? Like, we're going into the studio and recording as a younger man.
Sure.
Was it always very... was it ever very... nerve-wracking for you?
Oh yeah, I mean it's still nerve-wracking. It's still this process that every time I do it, the next record I make, I do in exactly the opposite fashion,
right?
Because
right.
I'm like, well, that didn't work, obviously. Like I've been trying to make records since I've been like 13 or 14, something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
And I remember like the first time going into a studio and being like, you know, like we saved up our, you know, allowance money
right.
and paper route money, and we're paying for this studio, which looking back was really like just this guy that probably sold pot and bought studio equipment in Tacoma,
right,
Washington.
Right. Yeah.
And we paid him money.
And then told you some extravagant story about somebody he worked with at one point.
Totally.
Which was probably a total lie.
Yeah. He was probably definitely living with his mother too. But anyway, yeah, like, even from that first experience, it was completely nerve-wracking. So then, like, you know, next time you do it, we're like, well, we're going to record at home. And then that doesn't turn out as well.
Right,
and then
right.
it's a wild pendulum swinging.
Yeah.
You know?
I used to always have a problem with, like, recording vocals in front of people. Like, that was always so fucking, like,
super hard.
Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it.
No, I mean, I heard, like, Yeah, like when Jimi Hendrix used to record vocals, like he would have to have like all the lights off and then like music stands or something like blocking his
really?
Face. So like no one even in the studio could even look at him.
So he felt like he was alone as well.
Yeah. And he famously thought he wasn't a very good singer, which was, you know, we know that to be wrong, but yeah, I know it's impossible to, because the singing thing, you want to do it correct and hit the right notes. And then you also want to like, you're like, I wrote these lyrics and I was thinking about a lot of stuff. So you want to put yourself in that headspace. And then, yeah. I don't know, it's like it's so much mental gymnastics to do the singing thing.
Yeah.
And there's people walking, like watching. It's terrifying.
It's totally terrifying. So you guys have this video out that kind of accompanies the new album, Taste for Blood, which comes out November 11th, by the way.
Yes.
And it's super good. I'm very impressed, if I haven't said that already. But there was this video, it was kind of like a making of video that you guys released.
Yeah, yeah.
And you recorded this video, or recorded the album in this big barn.
Yes.
Over in Carnation, right?
Yep, yeah.
Yeah.
This just massive, like, three-story barn. I think it was like 100 years old.
It must have been freezing in there.
It was, and we recorded this in January. So, yeah, like, if you look at that documentary footage, like...
That's right. You guys are wearing, like, huge coats.
Everyone, like, yeah. It's not just, like, cool Northwest fashion. And I have seen, like, bands play in clubs wearing their down jackets. And I'm the fuck are you doing? No, we were, like, freezing. So, and you... Since we're recording, we couldn't have a ton of heaters on because that gets picked up. So,
right.
Yeah, literally, it was, like... You know, like 14-hour days of tracking, and we're all in like beanies, and we have like long underwear on, and like down jackets, and in between takes, we're just like, you know, trying to get our like the feeling back in our hands and stuff like that.
Yeah, totally. It's hard to play when it's really cold too. I'm surprised that you guys stuck with that.
You know, we didn't. So, this whole album has been just a ton of like. Just kind of hustle, like doing it the way we can do it,
right?
Within the means that we can do it. And part of getting this big barn, which they usually rent out for like weddings and like concerts and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I think if we would have paid full price, it would have been something like $10,000 or $15,000 for like the week that we stayed there.
Just the space?
Because not only is it this huge barn, it's a lofted sleeping area with five bedrooms, and it even had like a little like dry sauna. It was pretty sweet.
Oh, that's cool.
But super lovely people that ran it, and I was like, hey, like we have this tiny budget. We want to utilize it. We're going to utilize it like right after the first of the year.
Yeah.
Because no, like there's no weddings happening then.
Nobody's doing it in the winter.
And it's a Christmas tree farm too. Is there?
Oh.
So like it's surrounded, it's this field of little like sapling Christmas trees. Mm-hmm. So they had just gotten done with their busy season of cutting and selling Christmas trees. So this was literally like the deadest period possible. So I was just like, I know you're not doing anything with this space. Like, can we have it for next to nothing? And they did, and they were extremely nice about it. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Did you get to use the sauna?
Yeah, like every day. What was great about the sauna was that it was actually, so it was, you know, a 5-piece band plus our two friends, Cameron and Lizzie from Radiation City. Portland band. Yeah,
they're fun. They're fantastic.
They're killer. So they produced the record. So that's like 7 people there. And then we had, a part of it, we had our good friend Morgan, who's actually, she's a professional vocalist and she's like our vocal teacher. So she was kind of on hand to like help out with vocals.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you see that documentary footage. Well, there's actually like 4 film guys there too.
Yeah.
They didn't stay the night, but
they have a drone. Is that how you guys got the aerial shots?
Yes. They had a little remote control helicopter that they put a little GoPro on.
That's awesome.
And did like cool sweeping shots.
Yeah. Yeah, that turned out really good.
Yeah, they're like all professional film dudes.
That's fantastic.
Who are all friends. And again, we don't have the budget for a film crew. So
right.
Pretty much the deal there was, since they're all like continually like producing material, they're like, well, if we can, you know, use this music that you're creating in future projects for free, then we'll come do all this documentary work for you.
That's awesome.
So, you know, and licensing, you know, cool indie bands is sometimes really expensive. So,
Yeah.
I think it's a totally good deal. Hopefully they utilize that.
Yeah. Well, it was a cool video and it was really interesting to see you guys do that. And the reason I brought it up is because there's a scene where you're doing vocals, you're tracking your vocals and you're standing with your back towards everybody.
Yeah.
Is that because you couldn't face everybody while you were singing? Or is that because the acoustics everything projecting out towards the doors was better?
I think that was because of the acoustics.
Okay.
It was this, you know, huge barn with like probably 50-foot ceilings. So like we kind of put me right in the middle and then baffled it with these big pieces of like foam essentially.
Right, right.
So I think that was purely an acoustical thing.
Gotcha.
But usually if I'm recording vocals, I want like all the lights off and to kind of imagine that no one's...
Oh, you think you're Jimi Hendrix, huh?
Yeah. I'm imagining I'm Jimmy is what's going on.
Ryan Devlin, channeling Hendrix.
Yep.
On the new Smokey Brights album.
Every day, just channeling Hendrix.
I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, like I said, it's a fantastic album.
Thank you.
And you guys, it sounds really well. It doesn't sound like it's recorded in a big open space like that.
Yeah, it's... I mean, we did all sorts of close miking and room miking.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, a lot of the room mics weren't super usable because this isn't a studio space. It's a barn. So like this guy, Jeremy Shearer, who mixed it, he's in Portland. He's really talented. I was like, why aren't we getting a lot of room sounds? And he was like, honestly, there's like machine sounds that like are... the thin walls of the barn kind of let in the outside world.
So you're hearing like farm equipment.
You're hearing like, you know, farm animals running around airplanes overhead and trucks passing by. So a lot of those like just super roomy sounds, which honestly you don't use a ton of in a record anyway.
Sure.
They kind of pepper them in. We didn't end up using a lot of those. But what was more important about that space was just like, we were, you know, all... seven of us, the band plus Cameron and Lizzie, were like just in one physical space doing one thing for like 8 days straight.
Yeah.
And it was like 16-hour days every day. And then we'd just go all crash in a, you know, big communal living area and cook breakfast together and get back to it. And that's more what I wanted. Like, I didn't fully care that it was a barn. I just really wanted to have a space where we could shut the outside world out and just do it.
That's what I kind of miss about playing music in a band too, is because there are those times where it's like you cultivate an experience, a life experience with recording an album, right? That's
absolutely
something that you will always remember. And
absolutely,
I will always remember, even though I'm not the happiest with how some of the recordings turned out in my old band, like I will always remember that experience. It was fantastic. Like we only had like a couple weekends at this place in Ballard, which has since been torn down, but it was so much fun. It was just like you spend a weekend. It was before I had kids too, so I could like tell the wife, I'm out.
Yeah, totally.
Spending 2 days just down in this little dirt hole, like recording this album.
Was that at Bob Street or?
No. What was it called? It was named after some character in The Hobbit.
I don't know.
crap. I can't remember. Adderbatch? I can't remember. Somebody's going to email me.
Someone's going to be furious that you couldn't remember the name of that. But
right.
If I was a better nerd, I would know. But yeah, that's the thing with recording.
It was so great. It was just like spending a whole weekend with a couple of really great friends and just in this like dark room recording this thing and spending so much time just drinking beer and hanging out and listening to the same vocal track over and over and over again.
Yeah. We don't do that. Like, as a society, like we don't spend, you know, weeks at a time doing one thing.
Sure.
Like everything's so broken up now. Like, you know, even when I'm working, I'm probably checking in on Facebook and answering texts, and I work from home a lot. So I'm, you know, watering the plants and doing laundry, and you don't often just do one thing for a long stretch of time.
Right.
And there's something really profound about doing that. And like, that's what I love about recording.
Yeah.
You're all of the gray matter just kind of goes to one task, and cool things come out of that. So,
yeah, totally. Yeah. Well, let's hear some more of it, shall we? We're featuring tracks off of the new album, Taste for Blood, out on November 11th. And this one is called, it's a great song, and I can't read my own handwriting. It's called Put Our Guns Away. And we'll be right back with more of the Air Raid Podcast for your ears with special guest this week, Ryan O'Toole Devlin.
Thank you, James.
You're welcome. You're welcome, James.
Yeah,
of the band Smokey Bright. All right, we'll be right back. Stay with us. Seattle native, born and raised, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I born in Seattle, and then by the time I got to middle school, my my family's business moved to Tacoma.
What was the family business?
Metalwork.
Metalwork.
Metalwork. You know,
like death metal work.
Yeah, it is dangerous. It, like welding and that kind of stuff.
I'm trying to make
stuff.
A joke here.
No, I know. And I was trying to go along with it. Yeah. No. Metalwork. You
metalwork.
Know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Aluminum. Steel.
Yes. Just good American steel.
Right.
We did like custom interior design stuff.
Oh, wow.
There was like more commercial space
for
that in Tacoma. There's actually just acres of it. You know, because it used to be this huge industrial city. So I hated it. Like I went from living in Seattle, which was just, I thought was just the coolest thing in the world, to Tacoma, where just in my mind, nothing was happening.
Yeah. And it smelled like the pulp mill, which it still does.
So pulpy.
Yeah. I love Tacoma though.
Oh, I do too. And I mean, I consider myself a Tacoma native just as much as a Seattle native.
Yeah.
So
when did you guys move?
We moved from Seattle to Tacoma when I was going from 5th to 6th grade. So I don't know. I haven't been around
children.
It's
kind of a bit, like, and we were talking about this a little bit too. Like, you kind of moved around in the area.
Yeah, I moved around a ton.
But in a city like this, like the areas, the neighborhoods break up, and you actually have to go to a different school.
And we mostly avoided that by, like, I moved around a bunch, but it was before the internet. And we just lied about where I was living, and I was living at my grandparents' house.
Okay.
So,
okay.
I got to go to the same elementary school, which was great. But yeah, like we lived in like Capitol Hill and the CD and Wallingford and, Queen Anne and, Skyway, is all over. But then, yeah, eventually Tacoma. So.
Yeah. Yeah. How was that moving though?
Because
then you're definitely going to a different school, right? From fifth to sixth grade?
I went from going to public schools to going to, like, a Catholic school. But, like, not just any Catholic school. And I didn't even know we were Catholic until then. But then all of a sudden we were very Catholic.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, explain that to me.
I mean, I think we...
You never went to church and then all of a sudden...
We'd been a few times, you know. But it was not all that normal of a thing.
Right.
And then from fifth to sixth grade, I moved from the city to, well, Tacoma's the city too.
Yeah.
To a Catholic school. And then, you know, it's like cheaper to be in parish as opposed to out of parish in a Catholic school. Uh-huh. So that's to say, like, you know, people that attend that church associated with that school, get cheaper tuition. So all of a sudden here we are every Sunday in church. And I'm like, and so, like, all these kids had already gone through all the crazy, like, you know, the water dunk challenge and the wafer eating challenge and all the, you're obviously not Catholic.
The
baptism and the, I think I was baptized, but I hadn't done the communion thing and I hadn't confirmed and all that stuff. So all of a sudden, like, now I'm among all these, like, you know, wearing a uniform, I don't know all these customs. And they just kind of speed me through it really quick. So I get, like, confirmed really quickly. And all of a sudden I'm like an official Catholic. And it was totally disorienting.
That's
and,
weird.
And I was
man.
Being taught by Irish nuns too. Like there was some, you know, normal American teacher people, but they're, you know, there were definitely these very old school, like, Irish nuns teaching me too.
This is fascinating to me.
It was
so
weird.
It sounds like it because, you know, let's see, normally in like a, you know, a public school, you're not going to get, you know, slapped on the wrist or something like that. You're going to be, you know, sent to the principal's office.
Right.
But in a Catholic school, that's a little bit different, right? Was the punishment scale a little bit different down there?
They still couldn't.
There was no hitting.
They couldn't slap you.
Okay.
They would remind you that they used to be able to do it. And like, oh.
What?
Oh, back
Are you serious?
Yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah. The, like, Sister Esther would just pine on about
Sister Esther.
The glory days of when she could just kind of smack kids around. But,
yeah.
What they would do is just, like, the most insane, like, just guilt trips, just to the point where, like, just, like, like shaming a class of children for
Can you give me an example? Like just telling a whole class that they're going to hell?
Kind of. Okay. So I remember, like, maybe this was sixth grade and it was like social studies class with Sister Esther. And it was April 1st, April Fool's Day. And she was a little late to class. So our wild hijink was to get on a stool and adjust the clock. So the clock was about 15 minutes fast. And then lo and behold, like 20 minutes into the class, it's recess time. And she's like, okay, class, it's time for recess. And like dismisses us. And we all like get up and like start giggling. And Sister gets wise to what's going on. And she makes us sit down and she tells us that the origins of April Fool's Day was this, like, just, she just painted this ghastly scene of the Romans just beating the holy shit out of Jesus and laughing at him and laughing at our poor Jesus. And
that can't be the true origin of it.
It's like, definitely not. It's like, it's so definitely not.
What the fuck? Oh my God.
A few of us were like, I don't think that's what, and you know, and of course we were just shamed extra hard.
Oh yeah.
But this was all new to me. I'm like, what? You can't lie in school. Like, right. And then all of a sudden I'm just getting a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, what else was weird about that? I mean, because you go from, like your whole life, you know, not being bombarded by religious studies.
Yeah.
I want to say, and then thrust into this whole,
and then it's part of the daily class.
Part of the thing.
It was pretty weird. I mean, and I totally appreciate it and like don't begrudge it. I'm definitely not a Catholic. I don't know. Some of the other weird stuff was just like the jumping into this weird social world, like going into it, you know, we have like uniforms.
Right.
And I'd never worn a uniform for class. Like I was like this kid from Seattle. I always wore like a lot of flannels and like torn jeans.
Sure.
And fancied myself a
this
little
is early 90s
little rocker kid.
Yeah, sure.
And all of a sudden we had to like go to the like the archdiocese run uniform store and like I had to like purchase like pants. I had to purchase them from the Husky section, which I had to learn what the word Husky meant.
Yeah.
And I was like,
were you a bigger kid?
I mean, I'm a 6'4" man, and I was always the biggest kid in my class.
Right, right.
I wasn't like a rotund child, but I wasn't skinny, and I'd never felt any self-consciousness about it until I was like, what's the Husky aisle? They actually had an aisle called the Husky aisle.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Anyway, like, I show up to class, and like, I'm the only kid that bought all the clothes from that store and everyone else has their own cool spin on the uniform.
Of course.
You know, it's like, you know, cool Jason has a slightly baggy non-pleated pant and like, so I was immediately ostracized for like getting the clothes from the uniform store.
Yeah.
And that was just terrifying.
Was there any part of you that was going to try to like reinvent yourself going to a new school? Like, were you going to try to be like,
no, it was
all right. This is what's going to happen. I'm going to come in. I'm going to fucking rule this place.
I mean, I think at that moment you're just like, I hope the other kids like me. Like there was no, just like, there was no teen movie sense of me being like, I'm going to bust into St. Patrick's and be the coolest motherfucker they've ever seen. I was just like, I don't know what this is going to be like.
Sure, sure.
So I don't know how we got onto this, but
it's fascinating. I love this kind of stuff.
It is fascinating. So for like 4 whole years, I was I was just immersed in weird Catholic culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, again, can't begrudge it because I made some of the best friends in my life and Catholicism is full of all this like cool, weird, dark imagery. And I think that always just stuck with me. So, yeah.
You said you're not a Catholic, but do you still like, are you a believer?
Mm.
Are you a believer in God?
That's complex.
Would you call yourself an agnostic?
No. I am constantly oscillating between how I would identify myself.
Uh-huh.
I would say I'm definitely a highly kind of spiritual person, thoughtful into the world of, you know, this is a hard one. Yeah. definitely not religious. Definitely don't think that just the moment you die, you're just a, you know,
it's gone.
Dead.
Everything's
and null
done.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So reconciling those two things, along with being raised in a very, you know, strict dogmatic religion,
sure.
You know, I think it's just kind of something that I'm constantly thinking about, but never making any firm decisions on.
Yeah,
just,
yeah.
You know,
I have a really hard time believing anybody who says. Like, even my dad has always said, like, you know, well, when you're dead, you're just dead. That's
right.
It. And I have a really hard time believing that he actually believes that. Because it's innately human.
Right.
To be like, well, what would it be like to be nothing?
Right.
Like, you can't even imagine it.
No.
Right? There's nothing, there's no sense that would give us any, you know, inkling to what that would be like, right? Do you understand what I'm saying?
There's just
that
no, come out there's, right? There's no context for nothingness.
Yes, there's no context.
Yeah.
So like you can't imagine it. You can never imagine it.
Yeah.
You know, unless you're some, you know, high up in the Buddhist religion and you can, you know, clear your mind of everything. Maybe that's
totally
what it's like. I don't know. But I have a hard time like wrestling with that. And that's something that I've been thinking a lot about lately.
Yeah.
Is like,
you're a father now.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're going to have to explain some big things.
Yeah.
To...
And how do I explain that? Mm-hmm. You know, that's like without pushing anything on my children, pushing any heavy thing on my children, like, you know, in an infinite amount of years of damnation if you if you do something wrong, you know? Yeah.
I just caught up with one of my best friends from growing up. He's got kiddos. He lives in California. Mm-hmm. And he was like, the only thing you can do for your kids is either fuck them up or not fuck them up. And he was like, just don't fuck them up. You know, don't fill them full of nonsense.
That's, you know what? But the kids who have the parents that are just like, we're not going to do anything that influences my child because,
well, that falls into the fucking them up category.
Yeah. They are their own person. And those are the most fucked up kids.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh yeah.
They come out of that. Like, that's what I've been seeing myself in like these schools that we now go to, these preschools and stuff, like the parents that are totally hands off and like hippie kind of like way, way left.
Oh,
liberal,
yeah. Yeah.
Style parenting where it's just like, we let our child, Peyton be like whoever, she wants to be. And, but we don't allow any pop culture into the house.
Right.
And it's like,
so those things don't,
you
really...
are, you, your kid is going to be a serial killer. Like, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You're creating a sociopath because that kid gets away with everything. Right.
Well, they're going to continue to look for any boundaries, walls, parameters to their world.
Sure. And they're not going to have one.
Cause they haven't been given any.
Right.
And, you know, there are parameters, there are walls.
Sure.
In like, you know, the more you grow up, the more you realize like, whoa, yeah, options are limited in a lot of ways. And you need to be aware of that. Like,
yeah,
you also need to be creative enough to work around it. But to imagine that there's just no boundaries at any moment, you're just going to be a rotten human being.
Yeah.
You're just going to be a self-entitled rotten human being.
And I noticed that the older that I get and the more I become involved with, you know, school things, you know, with my kids and stuff and meeting more people and stuff like that, there is like, you can spot that kind of person,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like out in the crowd, you can pick them out of a crowd because they are just
the
worst.
They're pulsating. Yeah, you can spot them from
just
a mile
the
away.
The worst, you know?
Yeah.
Oh my God. So let's get back on topic here. That was a little roundabout way of saying, so how did music enter your life, Ryan?
Oh man. I'm going to try and like push away all that other context and come at this new,
well, I was in the Husky session.
Yeah.
Section.
And I felt a lot of angst.
Yeah.
Man, how did music come into my life? Oh, is this not right?
Yeah,
okay.
Get that right in your
okay.
face hole there. There you go.
Now I'm closer to the mic, so my voice is richer. I don't know when it happened. I just like the youngest of age of just decision making. I was just like, I am going to be an artist and a musician. And I mean, I must have been.
Was it always guitar? Did it start out somewhere else?
No, my first instrument. So the first thing I picked up was piano, but I never continued on it. So I had a couple of piano lessons with this Bulgarian opera singer that lived in my grandparents' house, who they took in because she married an American man who ended up being a just abusive psychopath and kept her in a house in the woods.
What?
So she lived in our house. And she was apparently a famous opera singer in Bulgaria, but didn't like the way Bulgarian culture treated women. Moved to America.
Uh-huh.
through a mutual friend.
So wait a minute. Her husband was in. Her husband was in Bulgaria.
No,
and she moved away from that.
She married an American.
That kept her in.
Just it was, apparently it was just a terrible situation.
Yeah,
and
that's terrible.
My grandmother had a mutual friend also from Eastern Europe that was and so my grandparents lived in this just huge, when they bought it, it was just this horribly run down but beautiful Victorian home that they slowly renovated. But they had just a ton of extra bedrooms. So my childhood was always this kind of rotating cast of just weird characters living in these bedrooms, and one of which was this Bulgarian opera singer.
Yeah.
So she gave me a few piano lessons, and she would just walk around the hall, like the entire house, just like singing opera and just kind of being just beautifully insane.
Yeah.
So she taught me a little bit of piano, but then my grandma realized that she wasn't giving me any formal training. It was just completely like her own version of piano.
Yeah.
So instead of, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, the standard scale,
yeah,
she was teaching me in do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do, throwing in like flats there.
Okay.
And it was just a really weird introduction.
Uh-huh. So your grandma knew how to play piano then? She knew some of the basics at least.
She certainly knew some of the basics. I don't know if she knows any piano. I don't think so. But anyway, shortly thereafter, they introduced like band in school.
Uh-huh.
And my grandpa had a trombone around the house. He didn't really play anymore, but apparently at some point he played. So I was like, I'm going to play trombone. So I picked up trombone in like third grade. And then really liked that. And then I think in fourth or fifth grade, I decided I wanted to play the bass. And a bunch of my family chipped in. They bought me this little PV bass.
Oh, of course.
So
Predator?
It wasn't a Predator. This was later. It was just kind of like a P bass copy.
Okay.
Actually, I had it forever. I loved that bass.
Do you remember those PV Predators? They were the heaviest freaking guitars.
Yeah, they're just like made of just...
So one solid piece of wood or something, you know, that was just so heavy, and they were a Stratocaster copy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were...
They sounded good.
Really? Mm. I remember them just being awful. Like, I couldn't... Maybe that was just because I was awful?
Maybe they sounded good. I don't know. I remember a former bandmate of mine had one of those, and I was like... Maybe it was like, not so much like, that sounds good. It was like, yeah, that sounds good. Like, kind of in the surprised voice of hearing a PV... instrument doing something good.
Play Come As You Are again.
Yeah.
That sounds good.
No, that's very good in that voice. So let's see. Yeah, I got a bass in fifth grade, and then in sixth grade, like my family friend had like an electric guitar that he wasn't using, and
yeah,
I got that. And then pretty much at that point it was kind of all over. And
was that like, that was when like grunge was going on in Seattle? Every
12-year-old
kid had a guitar.
It was pretty grungy out there for sure. Like, mm-hmm. I was listening to a lot of like Nirvana and then everything that was less cool than that was forced upon you.
Right. Queensryche.
not a lot of Queensryche.
Candlebox.
Yeah, you know, more of the Candleboxes and stuff like that. And then, yeah, I think by the time I got to like seventh grade, like I started like a little, you know, garage band with the neighbor kid down the street that had some drums. And I don't know, after that, I've just always been like a band guy.
Yeah.
Just kind of chasing that.
That's great, man.
That joy, that folly.
Yeah. Has that always been the dream then?
Yeah.
Is to like incorporate music into all aspects of your life? Because I know that you work with Artist Home now too, right?
Yeah, I'm starting to do a little work with Artist Home. Uh-huh. I curated the the summer bonfire series at Golden Gardens this summer, and Kevin and I are like, you know, super good buddies and talk about music all the time.
Yeah,
and I booked the Columbia City Theater and. You know, I play in two bands, and I don't know. It's the only thing that truly interests me.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And like, I get just a profound amount of joy from it. It's also, occasionally frustrating because I'm just like, I don't know that an adult can just make their entire living doing this right now.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is it scary as well? Like seeing where the music industry is at this point?
Terrifying. Yeah. I mean, terrifying padded by, you know, all the fun I'm having. All the yucks and the joy I'm having. It's crazy. I mean, when I was a kid, I was like, well, I'm going to make records and I'm going to sell those records and that's what I'm going to do.
Right.
And it like, that wasn't that absurd of a dream. It was like definitely a pretty high in the sky dream.
Sure.
But the kind of thing that like, you just work your butt out off for a long time. But like, man, record sales are, it's not happening right
no,
now. Like one record has gone platinum this year. And she had a tie-in with like Subway to like advertise.
Right, right.
So unless you're Taylor Swift,
yeah,
you're not making a ton of money. And like I've talked to some friends like out on the East Coast that work with like indie labels, and they're just like, even our biggest releases are just maybe doing a couple hundred thousand right now. It's just like, so it's a little scary. Like if you thought you were going to be making records for the entirety of your living, that system is a little bit in flux right now.
Oh, sure, sure.
So, yeah, that's certainly something to think about.
Yeah. So working with booking, like you said, and are you still booking the Columbia City Theater?
I am.
As well?
Yeah, yeah.
So doing that kind of job, working with a lot of touring bands, being in a touring band by yourself,
mm-hmm.
Not by yourself, but yourself, is playing shows and touring where the money is then in music?
Yeah, conceivably, yes. It's if you just want to go for it and put out records and tour, it's still like certainly obtainable. Like,
yeah,
you know, you also have to kind of play that game and do the circuit and just go for it. So it's certainly still out there. And there's a million ways to do it too. Like, I have lots of friends that are essentially doing like full-time licensing work and then touring on the side, or like friends that, are super badass bass players and have like, you know, 10 students that they teach pretty intensely and then do their thing. So,
right.
And you know, I supplement it by booking and stuff like that. Which I totally enjoy and love cause I'm working with bands. So it's all doable. And you know,
does it ever get frustrating though? I mean,
sure.
You say you have a lot of fun with it, but I mean, even with just doing this show, like, you know, there are a lot of like really frustrating times, like, like booking for this show and having people cancel or having people not even just show up or, you know, just getting like, I mean, I really get down on myself sometimes about this show cause it takes a lot of fucking work and the output. The input does not equal the output, right?
Never.
Yeah.
And yeah, with that, you kind of have to stand back and ask yourself why you do it. And
also
look at yourself in the broader field of people that want to do what you're doing.
So do you think it will always be worth it?
I think playing music will always be worth it.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely. I think everyone has their own approach to doing this band thing. For me, I do it with people that I like, I truly love and enjoy.
One of them
is my actual wife. And then, you know, everyone else that's in Smokey Brights and in Hounds of the Wild Hunt, like they're like sincerely my best friends. Like I'm just, when I get done here, I'm going to go hang out with them. And that's not how a lot of people do the band thing. Like I know so many guys and so many bands that like just fucking hate the people they play music with.
Sure. Yeah.
But they're like, well, we're in a band together, and they treat it like it's like, well, you know, Bob's in accounting and I'm in HR and we have to work together, but he's a real dickhead. It's like, if that's how you're going at music, like newsflash, it's not worth it. I mean, unless, you know, you are the Rolling Stones and you've hated each other for years,
right?
But
you're
still just like raking it in. It, to me, at least from my perspective, the consolation prize, even if you're not raking it in, is like, I have like the most ridiculously fun times even playing the just wackiest Monday night show in an off city. Because right. I'm with, like, you know, people that I really enjoy and who, you know, believe in what they're doing as much as I believe in what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that makes it very fun. It's kind of the experiential prize at the end of it. You know, if you're not making a ton of money, I hope to God you're like having a good time and learning more about yourself and learning more about, you know, the world. And if you're touring, you're learning more about America or whatever country you're in.
Yeah.
So that to me is really interesting.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it certainly makes it worth it for now. So
that's great, Ryan.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so what's coming up for Smoky Brights? What, once this release is out, you guys are going on tour, correct?
Yeah. So we've got a few dates. We're pretty much just doing a lot of West Coast stuff right now. Mm-hmm. We'll be hitting a lot of Oregon, a lot of California, Eastern Washington. We're going to go out for a little over a week in December, and then in March we'll be out for a couple weeks.
Okay.
So all those dates haven't been announced yet, but if you go to like smokybrights.com or find us on, you know,
Facebook
/ Smoky Brights.
Yeah.
Then you'll see those dates. And if you're here on the West Coast, you'll definitely will be in your area. And then ultimately heading to the East Coast is going to be, it just takes a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we've got a scientist, a student, a lawyer, and then, you know, everyone works their job.
Sure.
And so it's kind of like a balancing act of like, all right, let's see what we can get away with and sure, take a week off.
Yeah. We'll do a week here, a week there. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good way to do it too.
It know? Is. And like I've done, like, you know, when my wife and I first started dating, I was on tour at least the first like 3 to 4 months of the first 6 months we were dating, which was, I'm just like amazed that it worked out. And yeah, we are too sometimes, like amazed and thankful, but like, I'm very interested in like keeping a balance of the, like, of the life and the touring.
Sure.
And the work. 'Cause it's amazing how often I see friends like put out a record, they've never toured before, and maybe they have an indie label, and their indie label's like, well, what you need to do is tour nonstop for a year, which is, it's true, but they also haven't like mentally or financially prepared for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known so many bands that like just put out a record, it gets some good reviews, they tour without preparing at all, and then they just break up
or
start hating each other or decide that they don't play music anymore. So
emotionally unprepared.
Emotionally unprepared.
Yeah.
I've done.
So do you think you're ready for touring this much?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, everyone in the band has, with the exception of Kim, has been on tour.
Yeah.
And Kim's first tour will be with her husband and her best friend, so it shouldn't be too bad.
Good.
I think
and you guys will have your own separate hotel room too at some of these places, right?
It's in our rider every night. We want the one with the vibrating bed.
Perfect.
Yeah, yeah, it's the honeymoon honeymoon tour.
And the heart-shaped jacuzzi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
totally.
We know you have one in the city, so just provide it for us, is what I say.
Yeah, yeah. They're not asking much, people. Come on.
Come on.
Yeah. You can find, like Ryan said, you can find out more about Smoky Bright's upcoming shows at smokybrights.com. Right? And then you guys are on Facebook and Twitter, and you guys can just search for that. And
Instagram, too. We're fun Instagrammers.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to follow you guys on Instagram.
Yeah, it's mostly,
I didn't know that.
Kim does all the social media, and she's way better at it than the boys. So she takes good,
a lot more diligent.
Good photos.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. Ryan, thank you so much for coming to the backyard and chatting with me for
heck
a little
yeah.
bit. I hope you enjoyed yourself.
Oh, yeah. This is awesome.
Yeah. And you can find out more about us at www.air-raid.net. Also find us on all those things, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, at Air Raid Net on Twitter. And you can also email me if you hate the show or you like the show. Doesn't matter. I read your emails. Sometimes I cry. Sometimes I laugh. And sometimes I write you back and say, you know what? Thank you for saying that. And you can do that at aaron@air-raid.net. So Ah, okay. Go to the website, go to the archives page, check out all 221 episodes.
Yeah.
Including Death Cab for Cutie, Mud Honey, Mike Birbiglia, Bob Saget, all those. And now, Ryan Devlin. Ryan Honored. O'Toole Devlin.
Honored.
Of Smokey Brights. Okay. Thanks for listening, everybody. And we're going to go out today with this song off of the new Smokey Brights album called Taste for Blood. The song's called Oh Well. Thank you so much for listening. Tell your friends about the Air Raid podcast, and we'll see you next week. I meant to live.